Series titled This Side of Paradise, A Look at American Religions. The series focuses on men and women who are joining religious groups outside the mainstream or reinterpreting the teachings and traditions of the religions they were born into. Each of these half-hour documentaries will begin Tuesdays at 4 o'clock during the month of October. At 4:30, we'll have a live follow-up conversation with two of the speakers featured on the documentary. During this follow-up, we'll invite you to call with your questions and comments. The subject of today's show is the Old Rugged Cross, Evangelical Protestantism. Following the documentary at 4:30, we'll be joined for the follow-up by Brad Allison, assistant pastor of the 10th Presbyterian Church, a nationally influential Philadelphia-based fundamentalist church, and John Gordon, a former fundamentalist who is now a chaplain at Albright College in Reading, Pennsylvania. And our phone lines will be open when they join us. It's a common assumption that feminism and its challenge to the traditional role of the wife is responsible for the drift away from the nuclear family. My guest, Barbara Ehrenreich, challenges that assumption in her new book, The Hearts of Men. She believes that the first rebellion against the nuclear family was waged by men who didn't want to be tied down to the emotional and financial responsibilities of supporting a wife and children. In the 1950s, Playboy magazine and the Beats were two manifestations of this male revolt against the family. Ehrenreich maintains that there have been two parallel struggles against the roles of the traditional family, one waged by men and one waged by feminists. Ehrenreich's book analyzes the ideology that shaped the breadwinner ethic and how that ideology collapsed. She's the co-author with Deirdre English of several seminal books on the history of women's healthcare, including Witches, Midwives, and Nurses, Complaints and Disorders, The Sexual Politics of Sickness, and For Her Own Good, 150 Years of the Expert's Advice to Women. She's now a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. If you'd like to meet Barbara Ehrenreich, she'll hold a book signing this evening from 5 to 7 o'clock at Giovanni's Room, the bookstore on 12th and Pine Streets. At 8 o'clock this evening, she'll speak on the subject, The Feminization of Poverty, at the Summit Church on Green and Westview Streets in West Mount Airy. And this is sponsored by DSA, the Democratic Socialist of America, and Barbara Ehrenreich is vice chair of National DSA. For more information about tonight's talk, you can call 843-2313. That's 843-2313. Barbara Ehrenreich's new book, The Hearts of Men, American Dreams and the Flight from Commitment, is published by Doubleday. Barbara Ehrenreich, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Let me ask you to explain, briefly summarize the thesis of your book in your own words.
Well, you did pretty well in summarizing it. I say that long before there was a revival of feminism in this century, that there was male resentment of and protest against the men's traditional sex role in the family, that of being the provider, the breadwinner, and the father. And it's kind of logical, if you think about it, that that would happen, because what a woman contributes in a traditional marriage of a full-time homemaker and a male breadwinner, what a woman contributes is not so easy to quantify or to see. I mean, if you do housework yourself, you know what it's like. You could work all day and there's nothing to show for it at the end of the day. But what a man contributes has been, in that traditional relationship, very tangible, the paycheck. And sooner or later, I think it had to happen that men would start saying, well, why am I sharing this anyway? Am I really getting enough out of this marriage?
Let's look at the male and female motivations for marriage. The roles that men and women play in marriage have traditionally been different. Do you think their motivations are different?
Well, I think that, there's always romance, there's always love, there's always sexual attraction. But when we leave those things aside for a moment, for women, a powerful motive has been financial. I mean, for decades and decades, women have been excluded from the more lucrative professions and occupations. A lot of my work with Deirdre English in the past was about the exclusion of women from the medical profession, but we know that this has been the pattern. Most of the jobs that have been available, open to women historically, were not ones that would pay enough to support you at a middle-class lifestyle yourself. So for women, it was pretty much like if we go back to the turn of the century, you either got married and had your own household that you established, or you would, what would you do? Work in a factory, be a, you know, what were the possibilities? Not many. So there has been a financial pressure on women that, of course, doesn't exist for men.
You've coined what I think is a new term. There's a common term called socioeconomic, and you've come up with the term sexuoeconomic. Do you think that marriage is a sexuoeconomic system where the man provides the money and the woman is provided for?
Well, I can't really take credit for that
oh.
word, that rather awkward word, sexuoeconomic. That was feminist Charlotte Perkins Gilman used to describe marriage. She was an interesting late 19th century, early 20th century feminist, because unlike most feminists of the time, she really believed that women would have to be economically independent to gain any dignity. She didn't think getting a vote was enough if you were still man's dependent in marriage. And she described marriage as a sexuoeconomic relationship. Very hard to say. I don't think that's why it didn't catch on. Where a woman, and she put it really brutally, very bluntly, a woman did various kinds of manual work and sexual services in exchange for money. She implied this is not too different from prostitution. So, I mean, that's been one of the old feminist complaints about the traditional marriage, is it was just not dignified to be in that position of complete economic dependency.
You use the term family wage to describe how a man who is the head of the household would be expected to earn a salary that could support his wife and his children. Now that the nature of the family is changing and there's a lot of single women who are parents, do you think that the family wage concept still exists when it's a woman who's supporting her family?
Well, the concept of a male family wage, I think, is still built pretty deeply into our culture and economy. And it's never been a reality, probably for many, many Americans, the idea that one man would earn enough to support a family. But it was certainly a reality, or has been for much of the middle class and large sections of the blue-collar working class. Now, did achieve, through union struggles, a family wage for the male earner, whether he was an auto worker or a miner or whatever. I don't think we have a family wage system anymore. I mean, fewer and fewer men make enough to support an entire family, certainly not at middle-class standards of living. And also what you just mentioned, there are so many women who are supporting children on their own or are principal contributors to their family's income that you can no longer, you know, that certainly the family wage system doesn't apply to them. But what lives on is the assumption that every woman in the labor force is really some man's dependent, and that's why she doesn't have to be paid as much. I mean, that's the historical assumption that still hangs over us and accounts for the fact that women earn, on average, 60 cents for every dollar that men earn.
You argue that in the 1950s, men were rebelling against the role of provider and the responsibility entailed in being the head of the household. You see that being manifested in Playboy and in the Beats. Let's start with Playboy. It was first published in 1953. What was the Playboy ethic, and how does that tie into your theme?
Well, I didn't know what I was going to find when I started reading all the original issues of Playboy. But what I found was that it read like a manifesto of male rebellion. You know, I know that it was partly one of the reasons it took off was that it did have pictures of nudes, and that was quite shocking for the time. But the other thing was that it really spoke to this male resentment. And the message from Hugh Hefner and the feature writers was, look, men, you don't have to put up with this. You're making money. Why have you tied yourself up in some kind of lifetime contract to one woman? There are millions of girls out there, women we would now say, and there are other things you can do with money. You can have a good time yourself. The Playboy was very misogynist. I mean, there's a good part about that message, I'm sure, you know, saying you don't have to accept this predetermined sex role, but it was very misogynist. wives were invariably described as parasites. Marriage was a trap, and married men were described as slaves. This is all in the pages of the 1950s Playboys. Single men were the free men.
And women were warned away from the magazine. I'd like you to read a quote here from one of the early issues of Playboy that you include in your book, The Hearts of Men.
Yes, this is from the very first editorial, in the very first issue, in early 1953. And Hugh Hefner wrote this. He said, quote, "We want to make it clear from the very start we aren't a so-called family magazine. So if you're somebody's sister, wife, or mother-in-law and picked us up by mistake, please pass us along to the man in your life and get back to your lady's home companion." End of quote. That's Hugh Hefner warning women away from Playboy magazine in 1953.
There's another quote I'd like you to read from Playboy, which shows how they thought that it was really men who were enslaved by marriage.
Right. This comes from a fairly amazing article as an insight into male thoughts about marriage. What it started with in this article was a fake ad that said, "Tired of the rat race, you know, fed up with the job routine, would you like to make all this money?" And they listed large amounts of money at home in your spare time, doing whatever you want, watching TV, and went through all this wonderful apparent job. And at the end of that beginning, it said, "This is something that 40 million Americans are already doing, their wives." You know, being a housewife was supposed to be this wonderful, good deal. And at the end of this article, which was, by the way, 1963 now, the writer said, and I'm quoting, "The last straw has already been served, and a mere tendency to hemophilia cannot be counted upon to ensure that men will continue to bleed for the plight of American woman. Neither double eyelashes nor the blindness of night or day can obscure the glaring fact that American marriage can no longer be accepted as an estate in which the sexes shall live half slave and half free." Close quote. And of course, when this male writer, William Iverson, was writing, the half free group that he was referring to was women, and half slaves were men. So this was the defiant male perception of marriage and men's and women's roles in it, well, for over a decade, as expressed in Playboy and some of the other men's magazines.
Is there any way of measuring the influence that articles like that had on its male readers?
I don't know how to, but, I mean, there's no way to go back and do the surveys. I know things that men have told me about, you know, reading it when they were younger, and the thrill, the defiant thrill of reading it, because it was in part so misogynistic. The letters to the editor were very supportive of this tone, the letters that I read. But I think what's amazing about it is that this was coming out at a time when the major magazines were family magazines, Life, Look, Saturday Evening Post, and they were talking about togetherness. The isolated suburban nuclear family was supposed to be the model for everybody. I mean, that was just so, the dominant culture was just pervaded with that. So that to come along and say, uh-uh, marriage is a trap, we want out, was really, if you want to think of it that way, a kind of radical thing to be saying.
I think a lot of women have always felt uncomfortable when their lover or spouse read Playboy or one of the men's magazines, because it's easy to perceive that as almost competition, that somehow these images of women are more exciting, perhaps, than the real woman this man is married to is. But do you think that women have, or that in 1953 women suspected that what Playboy magazine was also doing was suggesting to men that they didn't need to play by the rules of the family anymore?
I think women knew, and they didn't have to know about Playboy to know, because there was a lot of contempt for women as housewives that we could find all through the culture. For women, it was a serious double bind. You were supposed to, in the 50s, grow up to be a wife and a mother full time, and if you didn't, you were a failure. You were pathetic, a spinster, an old maid. On the other hand, if you did do the right thing, if you did play by the rules and grow up to be a housewife, what did you get? Contempt. Men muttered about, always talked about marriage being a trap. This is what I heard in my own family. And about wondering what it was that wives could possibly be doing all day to justify their existence. So there was a kind of a no-win situation. The contempt was palpable for women who, as I said, fit the role they were supposed to be filling.
At the same time, there were the Beats, who also advocated a role for men outside of the nuclear family. How would you describe that rebellion from the family and the motivating factors behind it?
Well, it was certainly far less mainstream than Playboy had become by the end of the 1950s. But the Beats were amazing, I think, as sort of genuine homespun American rebels, in that they rejected not only marriage, but also work. They took a big step. I mean, and with the Beats, we're really talking about a very much male-dominated and male-defined kind of counterculture, a very small counterculture. But it was small, but it was highly visible in the media in the end of the 50s. And, you know, these were men, too, who said, yes, the whole situation, marriage plus job is a trap, and you just don't have to live like that. But they went further. I mean, Hugh Hefner's model man was still a hardworking executive who had lots of money to spend. The Beats wanted to walk away from the materialism of American culture, as well as wanting to walk away from responsibility to women.
Oh, did the two ever meet? Did Hefner ever write about the Beats, or did anyone else ever write about them in Playboy and comment on how the Playboy lifestyle and the Beat lifestyle compared for men?
Oh, yes. Playboy was horrified by the Beats. I mean, it was kind of funny because in a way they'd been outdone. Playboy had been outdone by a rebel that went even farther. So Hugh Hefner wrote long editorials and called his own kind of reader the upbeats, because they still had confidence in free enterprise and business as compared to these downbeats who his magazine invariably depicted as wimpy characters compared to the virile Playboy type.
What do you think the social factors are that in, for instance, the 50s, while you had Playboy on one side and the Beats on the other, suggesting a lifestyle away from the nuclear family, what were the social factors that would keep the nuclear family going? Of course, there's tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But what were the other
social
motivating factors?
Well, there was huge amounts of social pressure. In fact, it's hard to see how radical some of these things like Playboy were without seeing how great that social pressure was. I talked about the pressure on women to get married. You were just, you know, a failure if you didn't, in the eyes of the public as well as the medical and the psychiatric professions. For men, there were also pressures that were ratified by expert opinion. And this was interesting to me because I've always been interested in how the female sex role is shaped in our society. I never really thought of the male sex role being shaped the same way. But the general opinion, whether you were talking to psychiatrists or your neighbors in the 1950s and well into the 60s, was that a man who failed to marry and become a breadwinner and father was a deviant, that he suffered from immaturity, overattachment to his mother, and or, quote, latent homosexuality, which was a very, you know, seriously stigmatizing thing to say about people. So this is what magazines said. This is what people said. I remember hearing it said of a man who was 28 years old and unmarried still, that, quote, you had to wonder about him. I didn't know what you had to wonder, but that was the... So that was the pressure. And I think one of my theories about Playboy is one of the reasons for all the naked pictures of women in it is that if you were going to say you were anti-marriage in the mid-50s, in the early 50s, you had to also go to great lengths as a man to prove that you were heterosexual. And the bunnies and the playmates sort of did that You could see that these rebels were not, had not crossed that line into what the rest of the culture would call perverse.
Were there movements in the 60s and the 70s that you think continued what you describe as the male revolt against the family?
Yes, I think it kept on going. That what was really happening through a lot of this time is that some of the old kinds of reasoning, the old kinds of pressures on men just weren't making sense anymore to more and more people. Or there were changes in how experts thought. One of the things I did research on was about how the worry about heart disease, coronary heart disease, in the early 60s contributed to a real reevaluation of this full-time breadwinner responsibility. I mean, men really do die of coronary heart disease more than women do. That's true. But from that simple fact, in the early 60s, many science writers, doctors, leapt to the conclusion, completely unwarranted, in fact, scientifically, that the reason why men were more vulnerable to heart disease was that they had this great stress of being the breadwinner. And that was a real turning point, I think, in how the male sex role was seen. Because before that, it was a matter of mental health to be a husband and provider. After that concern about heart disease, and it goes right on into the present, people tend to associate that kind of responsibility with sickness, that it's unhealthy to take on that kind of responsibility.
Which responsibility do you think it was referring to, the fact that you were the husband and provider, or the more specific stresses in the workplace?
It was both. I mean, it faded over to both. First, there was the assumption that it was much more stressful to work outside the home than to be a woman working inside the home. There's not much basis for that. Second, there was the assumption, we still have these assumptions, I think, and they're not based on a whole lot. The second assumption was that it's much more stressful to be an executive than to be a lower-level employee. No basis for that either. So the whole thing, it all blended together, and you found articles in the women's magazines in the early 60s practically accusing housewives of contributing to their husbands' early demises by being financially dependent on them.
Were you surprised at what you saw when you were reading magazines from the 50s and 60s, men's magazines and women's magazines? Did you expect to find these things?
Well, I certainly started with the hypothesis that there had been male revolt and male resentment against their role from way back. And that was partly just from what I remembered from the 1950s, that it just went in the face of a lot of kind of common sense things. So, I mean, the way we talked about the battle of the sexes when I was growing up in the 1950s, well, the battle of the sexes meant that if you were a girl, you had to, quote, land a man. And if you were a young man, you did everything possible to, I forget the way that would be put, but to get as far as you could go without being caught, you know. So it was this terrible tension, and you could see that the sexes had different interests. So I was pretty sure that I would find evidence of that kind of male resentment. I was astounded at how clearly it was articulated, though.
Barbara Ehrenreich is my guest, if you're just joining us, and we're discussing the subject of her latest book, which is called The Hearts of Men, American Dreams and the Flight from Commitment, and it's just been published by Doubleday. If I read you correctly, and tell me if this is accurate, you empathize with the male questioning of male and female roles within marriage, but disagree with the blame that was laid on women for it, you know, that there wasn't something wrong with the structure of the family the way it was and the way roles were assigned, but rather women were to blame. It's the wives who are the problem.
Yes, I think I have some, of course, as a feminist. I'm a feminist, and I have, I believe, in women's and men's liberation from traditional sex roles. I don't think any feminist would say, get back into the harness. You have to be husbands and breadwinners again. But I think that what we need to understand is that there were always real tensions and insecurities in the traditional marriage that I think many people romanticize now. It was always insecure for a woman to be financially dependent on a man and really to be dependent on his own volition, his own goodwill in bringing home that paycheck.
Do you think feminism started in parallel to the men's questioning of the family, or do you think that the men's rebellion helped spark the renewal of feminism?
Well, I would never give men credit for having sparked the feminist movement. I still think that Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, which we're nearing the 20th anniversary of the publication of it, is one of the best insights to how at least part of the feminist movement got started, that women who were full-time homemakers, and she dealt with upper-middle-class women in that book, were bored and restless. And doctors referred to housewife syndrome as a real disease that women suffered from because of the isolation and monotony and the futility of just repetitive household chores. So that was already there as a motivation. And then what I mentioned before, and Friedan mentioned many times in her book, is the contempt that men did have for homemakers. I mean, it's a funny thing if you think about it, because our society has always sentimentalized the homemaker, the mother. And yet I think there's always been this real contempt. It shows up in the fact that we don't pay homemakers anything, and it's only recently we've begun to talk about pensions and, you know, social security equity for women who've been homemakers. I think that may have contributed to the sense of women that they had to change, that they felt this contempt.
There's a very interesting phenomenon happening now in America, which is an anti-feminist backlash that many women are involved in. And as you point out in your book, some of the leading figures who worked against the Equal Rights Amendment were women. What do you think accounts for the women's opposition to equal rights for women?
Well, I think there are two kinds of things. Many of the leaders of the anti-ERA movement, I think, were pretty opportunistic about the issue. Phyllis Schlafly, for example, for 20 years before she even thought of a women's issue as something political to take up, was exclusively focusing on issues of militarism, building up our nation's nuclear arsenal and the threat of communism. Well, that was her theme for years and years. So there was something opportunistic in picking up in 1972 on the ERA. But then for many women, I think there was a kind of an appeal in what Schlafly and others had to say. I think that the anti-feminist appealed to many women's very real anxiety about their financial status. Because what Schlafly in her book, The Power of the Positive Woman, would say is, look at your situation, ladies. There you are. You've been married for 20 years and doing all these things for this man. Do you know he can leave you tomorrow for a younger woman? Happens all the time. I mean, that tone runs through Phyllis Schlafly's writing. And somehow she was able to get from that by several illogical leaps to saying, what we've got to do is stop feminism, because it's feminism that gives men the idea that it's perfectly all right to do what you want. It's a very limited connection. So I think that economic insecurity is there, and the new right very opportunistically picked up on that to get women mobilized in what was really against their own interests in fighting the ERA.
So do you then see the women's anti-ERA movement as being a response to what you call the male revolt?
Yes, definitely. I think that the anti-feminist real problem with feminism is that feminism has always been approving of men's changing or of men's not being in a fixed sex role either. And that's in the anti-feminist literature I read and in the interviews I did with some of the anti-feminist leaders, that came out clearly. They talked about men rebelling and what are we going to do about it, and how the women's libbers were just egging them on instead of tying the shackles tighter or whatever.
Have you ever put this idea out on the table in the presence of Phyllis Schlafly or another of the female leaders of the anti-ERA movement? I'd wonder how they responded to it.
That's interesting. No, I haven't had any responses. I think we would quickly be in a big fight because we might agree that there's this economic insecurity that many married women live with. But, you know, what that leads me to is let's do something about that economic insecurity. Let's make it so that if a woman is divorced or widowed in midlife, it doesn't mean instant poverty. Instead of what they would say is, well, how do we hold on to that man?
Barbara Ehrenreich is my guest if you're just joining us, and we're discussing the subject of her new book, The Hearts of Men, American Dreams and the Flight from Commitment, and the book has just been published by Doubleday. And she'll be speaking in town this evening and doing a book signing at Giovanni's Room from 5 till 7 today, so I'll have more information about that for you a little later. You've recently co-authored a book on the feminization of poverty, and obviously you see that as relating to the subject of the hearts of men, your new book.
Yes, there certainly is a connection. I mean, as if in a way men have freed themselves in a cultural sense from that breadwinner role, but as I was saying, the old assumption that women are dependents or secondary earners at best still hangs over us.
What do you propose as far as the relationship that feminists who are questioning roles within the traditional family and men who are a part of this revolt from the family have to each other? Do you think that there's a productive relationship that could come out of that?
Well, maybe. And a lot of the male revolt, what I describe as male revolt, is hardly very politically conscious. And I think a lot of men who would fit my description of being contemporary male rebels don't have a sense that that's what they're doing. And one of the reasons has to do with something we haven't really talked about is the consumer culture. I mean, that was a very big part of the change that occurred in the 50s, you know, the reason why men became more resentful, more questioning, is that there was more and more of a consumerist message being beamed to men. Now we have, you know, we have a whole, I don't know how to characterize them, we have a whole, a kind of a new man of the late 70s and 80s who is in his late 20s, early 30s, is not married, is investing his money in his running shoes and his vacations and his stereos. And if you asked him if he was a rebel, he would never think so. And, of course, he isn't. He's very much a part of the capitalist, the consumer society. But on the other hand, he is in the terms of an earlier generation's expectations of men, the expectation that you would earn money to support a family and not primarily for yourself.
Do you see new kinds of families being formed that you think are equitable?
I think that, of course, as people know, it's more and more common now to have two breadwinners, a man and a woman, in a married couple. On the average, a woman contributes about 27% of the family income in that situation, mostly in part because so many women will have to work part-time. Now, that puts a woman in a much better position than earning nothing. But it's still a small amount. And if the marriage breaks up, a woman who's only contributing about a third to the family income is probably going to be quite poor. You know, if the family had $24,000 a year altogether, they break up, she ends up with $8,000 and two children, that's under the poverty line. And the man would end up with $16,000 and perhaps no responsibilities for the children.
What do you think of the men's liberation movement?
Well, I have mixed feelings, partly because it's a very mixed movement. Right now, I think it's quite divided, one part of it being anti-sexist, pro-feminist, pro-gay and lesbian rights, another part being quite belligerently into men's rights. in a variety of ways that have to do mostly with divorce and child support payments, custody, and so on. I'm certainly not very sympathetic with that second part of it. I would like to think that men could work, you know, find ways to work directly. Men who want to work in anti-sexist ways could work directly with organizations like NOW and other women's organizations, that we should be able to all work on those issues together. I'm not to be frank with you, I'm not completely sympathetic with men's liberation when it sort of fuzzes out into personal, psychological, and self-improvement. Yes, men have to change, but I think they'll probably change faster through some concrete things like doing half the child care and housework and working in non-sexist, egalitarian ways with women than sitting around in a room discussing their angst.
Well, a lot of feminism got started through consciousness-raising groups.
Well, but it's different, though. I think it's different when you're members of the more privileged group, which men, certainly white men, have been.
Do you think there's an anti-feminist backlash now amongst men or amongst certain aspects of the men's liberation movement?
There's a kind of, I think today's version of the backlash takes the form of what's been labeled post-feminism, that really that feminism is something that happened. We had a women's liberation movement. Women got what they want. And thank God that's over. There's, I think men are a little less on guard about being sexist than they used to be. I know it's hard, of course, to trace these things. I think people get away with more sexist statements in the media than they might have a short time ago. I'm just thinking of William Buckley's article in the Sunday New York Times magazine a couple of weeks ago defending men's only social clubs in very sexist terms. So I think there's some slippage, and it comes from the sense that and we tend to have this great sense of turnover anyway as Americans. You know, anything comes along, the next day we're reading about post-whatever it was before anything's been achieved. And I think that's the form that, if it's a backlash, it's taking. And it just makes me more anxious as a feminist to remind people how much there is to do until we have anything like equality.
What are finally the implications of your theory? You're suggesting that it's not just feminists which have posed a challenge to the nuclear family, but you know, for decades now, there have been men who have been challenging that too, and who have challenged the responsibility and the stress of the whole breadwinner ethic. What are the implications of that? I think it's a different way of looking at recent history than the one we're accustomed to.
Well, a big question is where do we go from here, I think. I don't think there's any chance of going back to the old arrangement between the sexes, and I think most women would reject that, certainly would reject that. I think that many things have changed, while other things frustratingly have remained the same. Like I said, the fact that women are paid so little, as if they weren't really serious breadwinners themselves. Another thing that I don't think has changed fast enough is men's attitude toward women. I think that many men have wanted their freedom, the tradition of the male revolt I talk about. On the other hand, I don't think that the same men have often been willing to overcome their own sexist attitudes. The contempt for women continues and is expressed in many ways in our culture. There's this terrible schizophrenic thing on the part of a lot of men who, on the one hand, don't want to be married to somebody who earns more money than them or who has a strong independent career. On the other hand, don't want somebody who, as one man just put it to me recently, is all clingy and dependent. So that's, you know, you can't have both. I think men have to, you know, get their heads together, as we used to say, and catch up with the changes.
Can you remember back to when you were first starting to date and entertain the idea of marriage or a long-standing relationship with a man, how the popular ideology in magazines affected you personally and your expectations of men and what you thought they expected from you?
Yes, I can remember. This is remembering back now into the late 1950s when I was a teenager. My impression and as a teenage girl was that if I wanted to make anything of my life, I would have to avoid marriage and motherhood and all those things, because it seemed like all the pressures were to fit into that role, and that once you slid into it, it would be all over for you, and that there was no possible combining one's independent aspirations with that. So I had this very rebellious idea that I would be one of those lone women who could somehow keep out of the trap. I don't think young women have to feel that way anymore at all. There aren't the pressures on them to get married. They're not going to lose, you know, have no respect if they don't have three children by the time they're 28. In fact, what I hear more often from young women today is that a very opposite sense, that they wonder how they might ever possibly get into a relationship that would be stable enough so they could have children, because they see a lot of turmoil, they see in their own lives very short relationships, serial monogamy. So it's a completely different set of expectations, I think, that we had 20-odd years ago, and young women have now.
Did you ever identify with men who didn't want to date you for too long because it would mean they'd be tied down?
Well, I can't say that. I think I was very intrigued by the Beats, who really existed in those days. And I was fascinated that people could be so different from the very conformist middle-class high school culture that I saw around me. I mean, we didn't have a whole lot of rebels in sight. Communism or the Communist Party, leftism, that kind of rebellion had been pretty well squashed or silenced by the McCarthy years. There was the beginnings of a civil rights movement, the very strong beginnings by the late 50s. And then there were these curious people, the Beats, who were just intriguing, I think, to young women as well as young men. The sad thing was that you knew if you were a young woman, you could only admire them, you could never be them.
Can I ask you what decision you've made about your own family as an adult? Like what you've opted for?
Well, it's not so much opting always. It's sometimes improvising. Mm-hmm. I'm a single mother, divorced, with two children, and I should say it's not my own experiences in my family that led me to look at the male revolt. I should make that clear. But I think I'm one of the 9.4 million women now who's a single mother raising and supporting her own children. I feel very strongly that our type of family not be thought of as, quote, a broken home or something that's not legitimate, but that it be understood that we are legitimate families, that many kinds of living arrangements, which are not the traditional ones, are legitimate families too, and that the real problem with most female-headed families is not that they lack a man, but that they lack a man's wage. And there's a great deal of poverty amongst women who are single mothers. And I think that's a social issue that we are left with in the aftermath of these changes in the family.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. It's really been interesting to have you here. Barbara Ehrenreich has been my guest, and we've been discussing the subject of her new book, The Hearts of Men, American Dreams and the Flight from Commitment, and this new book is published by Doubleday. She'll be spending the rest of the day in Philadelphia, and let me tell you where she'll be if you'd like to meet her. She will be holding a book signing at Giovanni's room, the bookstore on 12th and Pine Streets, from 5 to 7 this evening, and then at 8 this evening she'll speak on the subject, The Feminization of Poverty, at the Summit Church on Green and Westview Streets in Mount Airy. And this talk is sponsored by the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, and she is vice chair of National DSA. For more information about her talk this evening, you can call 843-2313. That's 843-2313, and a donation is requested if you attend. Barbara Ehrenreich spells her last name E-H-R-E-N-R-E-I-C-H, and the new book again is called The Hearts of Men, and thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.
This is Ted Dameron, and by the way, in just a couple of minutes on Fresh Air, we'll be hearing the first in a new four-part series called This Side of Paradise, a series of four documentaries on American religion, and the subject today will be evangelical Protestantism. That's coming up in just a couple of minutes on Fresh Air.